morning, everyone. We're going to move into our hearing here, but first I want to reinforce a message that we have been trying to announce. When you send emails to this committee on legislation before us, it will get entered into the public record. However, if we get 500 emails with the very same exact language, that will mean one message into the record, not 500. So I know there are associations that encourage you to send emails, and here's the language you should use, and so that's how that happens. So we're getting all of those, don't worry.
But all the individuals will be under one file.
Right.
For that subject.
I'm going to open up a public record on Senate Bill 565. Dr. Warner, can you give us a summary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sitting in for Chris Allenack, who's in another committee and working on other tax credits. Senate Bill 565 creates a personal corporate income tax credit for a state historic rehabilitation fund. It sets up an auction process by the Department of Revenue and the State Historical Preservation Officer. It limits the amount of the tax credits to be sold to $12 million a year. The tax credit is non-refundable and has a five-year carry forward. It applies to tax years 2016 through 2021. The tax credit sunset date is 1/1/22. Money contributed to the fund shall be used to provide rebates to property owners who complete eligible material rehabilitation projects. The maximum rebate is 25% of eligible expenses, up to $2 million. The eligible expenses criteria are set in the bill. Application for rebates must be submitted by July 1 of 2015.
All right. Do we have a revenue impact?
Mr. Chair, we do not have a revenue impact at this time. There is a limit on the amount of tax credits that can be sold at $12 million per year. And so we would assume there would be probably a startup period before we would hit that limit, but we would likely hit the limit pretty soon, given the interest in it.
Okay. And we have some people here that want to talk about that, quite a few. So we normally don't get in the business of setting up clocks and timing witnesses, so we won't do that. If you can all keep your individual testimonies to about 2 minutes, we won't put you under the clock. If you have some written testimony that you'd like to hand into the record, that'd be great. And please don't feel the need to read directly from it, because we'll all have that. So with that, let me start off with a group here. I've got Peggy Moretti, Sharon Canepa, and Elena Garner. Hello to you. Welcome to the Capitol.
Good morning. Let me do this. And I'm going to be showing a video in a minute. Anyway, I get to go first. Wonderful.
Start off with your name and ID for the record, please.
Yes. I'm Peggy Moretti. I'm the Executive Director of Restore Oregon. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today and for introducing the Revitalized Main Street Act, SB 565. We are, Restore Oregon is a statewide nonprofit, I think I should scoot in, a statewide nonprofit whose mission is to save Oregon's historic places and promote livable communities. We are leading a broad coalition here of individuals, businesses, government agencies, and organizations who believe that a state rehabilitation incentive is a very good investment that will pay big dividends. And I'm joined here by Sharon Canepa, Mayor of the City of Albany, Elena Garner, who manages the Astoria Downtown Business Association. And over there, part of our core team here is Julie Garver, who is the development director of IHI, who is an affordable housing developer, and they all have some perspectives on our bill that they're going to share with you. But first, if I may just set the stage, we have a short video that captures the essence of what we're trying to accomplish. And if I know how to operate this, we can play that for you. Is it there?
It's loading.
There we go. Oregon's main streets matter. Our historic downtowns are the economic heart and cultural soul of their community. But many are at a tipping point, half empty, their historic facades in urgent need of repair and restoration. Thankfully, there's a small army of intrepid citizens working to bring their Main Street back to life. They're eager to remodel upper floors into housing, transform warehouses into office lofts, convert old movie theaters into art centers, reopen shuttered hotels, and launch restaurants that showcase local produce and microbrews. But these Main Street entrepreneurs are missing an important financial tool to cover the high cost of restoration, code upgrades, and seismic retrofitting. The Revitalized Main Street Act creates a State Historic Rehabilitation Fund to provide a 25% rebate on the cost of fixing up historic buildings. It could literally transform Oregon Main Streets from Astoria to Enterprise. An economic impact study determined that for a small investment capped at $12 million per year, our state would greatly spur private investment, resulting in four times more historic buildings rehabbed and reused, creating over 1,300 new jobs per year and income exceeding $25 million. The restored buildings will generate $2.3 million more in property tax revenue to pay for schools and services. We'd capture over $13 million new federal tax credit dollars in Oregon and see nearly a $34 million annual net increase in our state GDP. Passing the Revitalized Main Street Act is the single most important thing we could do to save Oregon's historic downtowns and commercial buildings. 35 other states already have a historic rehab incentive. It's time Oregon did too. Tell your state legislator that Main Street matters. Pass the Revitalized Main Street Act. So that's a little overview. Restore Oregon has been working with Oregon's Main Streets for over 5 years to identify solutions aimed at their revival. And the Revitalized Main Street Act is the outcome of that effort. It's designed to spur economic development and will attract much-needed private investment to bring our original downtowns back to life. And this is especially important in rural communities. So as you could see, SB 565 creates a historic rehabilitation fund with a 25% rebate for the rehab of historic commercial buildings. And that would be stores, hotels, theaters, apartments, warehouses, and decommissioned schools, for instance. It would be funded by the public auction of state income tax credits capped at $12 million per year. And at least 30% of that fund would be directed towards smaller rural projects. So it targets our most important buildings, those listed on the National Register of Historic Places. And we estimate that there are about 2,600 buildings in about 77 towns that would be potentially eligible. It would be administered by the State Historic Preservation Office. And Chrissy Curran is here today to answer questions if you have those of her. So in meetings with some of you, we've been asked the question, do we really need this? And I would, of course, say we absolutely do. The high cost of restoration and code upgrades and seismic retrofitting, which, by the way, can add 25 or 30% to the cost of rehabilitation projects, often leaves a funding gap that just can't be closed with traditional financing alone. And the good news is we know this works. Similar incentives have already been tested in 35 other states to attract private investment and stimulate economic development. Plus, it can be stacked with federal and local incentives, making it possible that buildings who have stood empty for decades can be restored and their upper floors reactivated and occupied and made productive. So how will Oregon benefit? We think this is a modest investment with a really big impact in terms of job creation, downtown vitality, sustainability, and seismic safety. An economic impact study by EcoNorthwest found, quote, Oregon would indeed be better off with a state historic rehabilitation incentive. So passing the Revitalized Main Street Act means that four times more buildings will be rehabbed and reused, and that in turn will create over 1,300 jobs per year with income around $25 million. These are good paying jobs. The increased property values will generate $2.3 million more in annual property tax revenues. We will more than double the amount of federal tax credit dollars captured here in Oregon, see an increase in our state GDP of nearly $34 million per year. And by 2025, the buildings that we've restored will house over 12,000 jobs. And I think we've all noticed that most of the new tech companies, those creative class people, the artisan food people, those companies all want to set up shop in historic buildings. And I've also noted that tourists rarely pull off the freeway to go walk through our strip malls. They're looking for those historic places to go visit. It's worth noting that what we're doing here is not ephemeral. It is tangible and lasting. By passing SB 565, we're restoring tangible assets that will serve their communities for decades, while also embodying its heritage. Passing the Revitalized Main Street Act will result in a visible legacy that will outlive us. I'm pleased to report that as of yesterday, our list of those endorsing the Revitalized Main Street Act include hundreds of individuals, organizations, businesses, and government agencies. It includes 35 mayors and city councils, 30 downtown business associations, 33 organizations, and representatives from 64 cities, from Burns to Astoria, Baker City to Coos Bay. It's embraced by a wide range of interests, from the Oregon Chamber of Commerce to Thousand Friends of Oregon. We'd like to say that the R's and the D's find common ground on Main Street. The Revitalized Main Street Act has been designed to be focused, accessible, equitable, and cost-effective, and is particularly needed in rural communities. So it's a wise investment that will pay dividends for decades. And I would just reiterate our little theme here, the Main Street matters. So please do vote yes and pass the Revitalized Main Street Act.
Okay, done?
Yes.
Okay. Good morning, Senators and Chair Haas. Thank you for this opportunity to be here this morning. My name is Sharon Canopa. I'm the mayor of Albany, and I'm here on behalf of myself. I have this item coming up to for our city council support, but I didn't get it on the agenda in time, and this committee here came sooner than I expected. But we will be visiting this item to be endorsing Senate Bill 565. As it is time our state fully commits to a commonly used financing mechanism for historic preservation. Our state of Oregon has a disadvantage compared to 35 states across our nation, which already provide state historic tax incentives. There are many countries throughout our world who have preserved their past with a wide variety of architectural designs, many beautiful ornate structures, and over 1,000 years old. Our own nation on the East Coast has historic structures over 300 years old, including significant government buildings. This shines on the many committed government leaders who made sure their future citizens can experience the history of our country, as Oregon should be doing the same on the West Coast. In Albany, we are proud of having one of the largest variety of historic stock in the state. We value our history and preserve our past. Albany has a successful urban renewal district that provides financial assistance to support significant historic buildings with their revitalization. What I have found is a missing piece with some challenging structures. By not having an option for additional financing assistance in order to make a project feasible. Revitalization of historic structures usually costs more than new construction, yet can lessen the burden on the costs associated with urban sprawl. There is less capital needed to support capacity projects for water and wastewater lines, less demand for expanding the transportation system. The increase of public facilities and historic revitalization slows the pressures of urban sprawl on farm and forest lands. To expect the free market will revitalize all of our historic structures without any assistance is why we have many historic structures in dismay across Oregon. If it was more feasible to revitalize historic structures compared to new construction, we would not be here today asking for your support of this bill. Every city across the nation can construct new buildings, and most likely they all look the same. But nothing can replace the beauty of a historic structure. Our history is Oregon's character and identity, the same as Chicago, New Orleans, or the capital of our country. Also, historic structures is a major piece of tourism in our state. Please support and move forward Senate Bill 565. The pressure is on you now to commit to preserving our past, as this financing tool request will not go away. Let's not wait until Oregon ends up being the last state in the nation to financially commit to historic preservation. Thank you for your consideration. And I also kind of want to add is one piece when I look at it, it's like, you know, we get criticism also on our historic preservation in Albany and mostly with our urban renewal district that we do have. But it is successful, and I always look at it, we have a problem that we identified where we needed to revitalize our historic buildings. And if somebody doesn't like that mechanism, then please give us another workable solution. So that's what I ask also. If this is not a piece here that you can support, please give us a workable solution. We need to take care of our history in Oregon. So, thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for having us here today. My name is Elena Garner, and I am the Executive Director for the Astoria Downtown Historic District Association. So I'm going to abbreviate that. It's ADHDA, is what we call ourselves. So, and ADHDA is a performing Oregon Main Street community. I have been involved with the Main Street program for 3 years now, 3.5 years, 2 years in Eastern Oregon in LaGrande, and most recently in Astoria for a year and a half. I am here this morning on behalf of the Downtown Association to ask for your support for SB 565, the Revitalized Main Street Act, and please to vote yes to pass it forward. Living in Astoria now for a year and a half, there's been a lot of wonderful changes over the past few years. However, there's still more work to be done. There are many dilapidated buildings at the end of downtown that could really use this type of financial tool and resource to help take those buildings to what they could be. They are prime commercial property, but have been vacant for since the early 1990s. There are numerous opportunities in Astoria that still need economic help, as well as in Eastern Oregon. Spending 2 years there, there's many buildings that could really use this type of support. I didn't really prepare a lot of detail, but I just, working with Main Street, it's a really wonderful program. There are lots of resources available, but there, this one I think would really help close that gap. It would have that economic impact of job creation and would really support our communities at a local level that would have state and nation impact. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I want to let you know that this bill is being sponsored by this committee, all of us up here. And so it's not that we're unsympathetic or non-supportive, but we do have to ask some devil's advocate questions.
Okay.
Because the hardest job for people on the Revenue Committee is to know if they give an incentive, are we giving an incentive for something that might be done anyway, and therefore taking money that would otherwise go to education, higher education, schools, programs for the poor, and those things, and unnecessarily giving it to a developer who might be ready to do this anyway. So we're asking those kinds of questions, and but please keep in mind the spirit in which we are asking those. And so in that spirit, I would ask these questions. You know, I've stayed at the Astoria Hotel, and I was recently in Sisters, and they have beautiful main streets without this program. And so, you know, at what point do we know where's the right sweet spot here to encourage and incentivize perhaps for less, maybe it's more, and how did you arrive at this, and how do we know that this is the right amount, I guess is what I'm interested in your answer.
I can answer some of that, or start, and please, please chime in. Mm-hmm. I think that there are definitely examples of some already revitalized buildings in selected places and main streets across the state, but you are also probably keenly aware of some very, very sorry looking buildings that if this was going to happen without any incentive would have happened. You know, I mean, I think there are literally hundreds of buildings across main streets in our state, and in fact, the reason we've gone as a nonprofit who has no financial gain to be had for this effort, the reason we've tackled this at Restore Oregon is because we've been hearing for 5 years this really extreme
call for help from all the various downtown districts that we've been working with across the state, that they just, they've got this inventory of buildings that are just not moving into, you know, there might be a little bit of retail on the bottom floor, but the upper floors are vacant and they are deteriorating. The other thing that is a really important consideration with weighing what the need is here is that occasionally you'll see a building that's got a fresh coat of paint on it, but the inside of it is not in good shape at all, and it has no seismic retrofitting that's been done to it. And this is going to be something that will definitely help take a significant step forward with getting these unreinforced buildings in a much safer condition. In Sharon's community, we have the St. Francis Hotel as a wonderful example of do we need this? It's a four or five story.
Four stories and a basement.
Yeah. This is an empty hotel, basically. It's got a little tiny bit of retail on the first floor. The upper floors are vacant. People there in the community have been trying to get it restarted for years and years, and the numbers just don't pencil out because of the need to do all the code upgrades and the seismic retrofitting and add a new elevator and all of these considerations. The numbers just simply don't pencil out. And I believe one of our testifiers later in the session here will speak to some of the nuances of that financial pro forma wrangling that goes on. But we actually did a specific study of that property as a case study and recognized that the gap that's, even with all the other incentives that are out there, even with all the other efforts and a really solid, viable reuse strategy, the idea is to turn it into both a combination of a boutique hotel and some apartments, which would have a huge bump in then the activity and vitality of downtown Albany. Is just not going to happen without some sort of a state incentive that could help close that remaining gap. So,
and I can add to that. So St. Francis is not the only historic structure that we still have had some missing links to be able to make a project feasible. This is my 19th year on the city council, and I have been working hard trying to revitalize our downtown all these years. And this has just been a very challenging piece, plus a few other structures. So it is just not feasible without some other sort of assistance. And that would be including they could get, federal rehab, credits, plus our urban renewal. We're very committed, with our urban renewal dollars. We have brought in $75 million of private investment by leveraging $12 million of urban renewal dollars just in our downtown area. So I don't know if you've been to downtown Albany, but we have really done a lot of wonderful changes, but we still have more to do, and it's just been a very struggle to be able to get that some of the historic buildings revitalized. But looking at the policy side of it, how do you weigh, what your question was, Senator Haas, is how do we weigh that balance between funding this type of program over against schools or other programs? When you do have sort of, your history is basically building a healthy community, too. If you don't have a healthy community, it makes it hard to have healthy schools, too. We do have a historic school, elementary school, right in the heart of our downtown that has been very supportive. It wouldn't be there today if it wasn't for our revitalization in our downtown area. And it's bringing in more families that are living in the upper floor housing, and their kids walk to the schools. Senator so in Edwards. A way, it's benefiting that school because, you're being able to bring new life to this area.
Senator Edwards, did you have a question?
Yeah, I have a question for staff, and then I have three or four questions for the panelists. What is the total amount of tax credits that we have been allotted or budgeted in the co-chair's budget framework to allocate this legislative session?
The co-chair's budget framework allocates $14 million for 15-17 biennium.
$14 million total. Okay, that's what I thought. So my questions are about how you might envision tailoring it, shrinking this program up. It's a great, I'm with you on the value there. And I echo the sentiments of the chair in prefacing our questions. This program is proposed at $12 million. We have $14 million total, and I don't know how many tax credit bills. This is a budgeting process that we're going through, and we have to decide how to how to allocate those. So my questions are, is it envisioned, and I haven't read the entire bill, I skimmed it, but perhaps you can tell me if it's in the bill currently. Would this program be first come, first serve, or would it be allocated on a competitive basis? If it is on a competitive basis, are there certain criteria that would be viewed? You know, is it a part of an overall plan for a downtown in order for that building to qualify, or is it a one-off? And then how are historic buildings defined? That's all my questions. So
the historic buildings that, as we are defining it within this bill, are buildings that are listed on the National Register of Historic Places or are what they call a contributing building within a National Register Historic District. So we think there's about 2,600 buildings across the state that are commercial buildings. We're not talking single-family residential here. Our National Register eligible in that sense. In terms of how the first come, first serve, we haven't set up the administrative rules yet of how that money would be allocated, and we recognize that one would like to think that maybe there'll be some more dollars going into that pie or that pot that you get to so judiciously dole out. So we know there's probably some need to see if this is the right number to ask for or not. But the number we picked was based on a sense of demand that was determined from Eco Northwest. So obviously we would be practical in what will work here. So anyway, the administrative rules would be designed a little further down the road. But what we imagine is a system where the building property owner or manager would make application based on the plan they have already for the rehabilitation of the building, and that has to meet standards for historic preservation, so that you have to respect and retain the historic integrity. So there'd be an application that they'd get sort of a certified, yes, this is meets the criteria. And how they would go about allocating monies if there's more demand than there is money in the pot, we haven't nailed that down yet. But our goal is to be equitable. And we definitely have written into the bill that this is going to be designed in a way where, a couple of Portland projects cannot eat up all the money in the pot, because at least 30% small projects are eligible for the whole pot, but at least 30% is to be specifically directed towards small projects in rural communities.
Senator Boquist, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to have a clarification with staff, and then I have a question for Astoria, so they better listen up here. And they don't have to answer it either, because it's going to get hostile, I think. The good news is, Mr. Chair, we actually have $65 million, I think, roughly, in tax credits that we have, a $14 million budget. And I just want it onto the record, and staff can validate this, that I'm correct. I just killed $3.5 million in tax credits in my committee, and we're not going to see it because it's not coming. So we're more than willing to make sacrifices elsewhere to move things around. But Mike, that is correct. We're at $65 million, $14
million. Yes, Senator Buckles, if we extend the sunsetting tax credits as they are now, it would be $65 million for the 15-17 biennium.
Right, and if I'm correct, a lot of those are low-income tax credits. Are those correct? Is that correct?
The largest is the working family credit, and a number of them are low-income, yes.
All right, okay. And certainly it's an odd situation. My question, though, is we have a series in Astoria, a series of historic buildings that are along the waterfront. What we're trying to do here is encourage the redevelopment and the expansion and the restoration of those. But at the same time, the state Division of Lands has doubled the rate for the submersible properties underneath those to put the money, in theory, into the school fund, which we talked about competitiveness here. So now we're going to try and do tax credits to subsidize the building of those, but it's a zero-sum game. If you're looking at us, this money comes out of the general fund, we'll be sending it to schools and elsewhere. And so, I mean, does Astoria have a position on along the waterfront here? Because you see where I'm going here. I mean, state lands has doubled the rate, which is going to drive people out of those buildings, and then we're going to try and get people to go back into those buildings with this.
Right.
And I happen to be, I'll be quite biased. I like yours, and I don't like state land. So that gives you a little talk.
We have a hearing on this this afternoon in my committee.
Mr. Chair, Senator Edwards is exactly why I raised this.
I will say for this specific bill is it is focused on the downtown area. And so our downtown district is from 5th to 17th from the river to Exchange Streets. But certain parts of the Riverwalk are not included within the historic district. So in terms of funding, I don't want to get too much into it, but I'm obviously in favor of the historic district, supporting that. I know that the city of Astoria is working with a riverfront vision plan that is broken up into four different sections. Part of that section coincides with the historic district, but broadly speaking, they are two separate entities, and I have a passion for historic buildings.
Well, thank you all for coming up. We have a lot of people to hear from today, so we'll keep you on standby.
I do want to quickly clarify that those waterfront buildings, if designated historic, would certainly qualify for this.
And for the record, incentive. Mr. Chair, they are.
Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up another panel, Walt McMoney's, Mayor of Lake Oswego, whose writing I cannot read, Pam Hayden, and
Julie Garber, by any chance?
Yeah, I understand. Julie Gardner. And Rep. Boone is here, biding her time between her ways and means obligation, and so when she gets back up here, we can slip her in. Oh, she's right there. Okay, Rep. Boone, can we pull you in here? I saw you in the back, and then can we pull up a chair there?
If that's appropriate. She's a fireman. She
can.
No,
let's get a chair. Let's get a chair there.
Here, chair.
Maybe that lady.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks. Sorry to cause a little dust up here. I'll be brief. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32. Thank you, Senator Hass, for sticking me in here. I've got another committee on, and hello committee, I'm just here to support this bill, Senate Bill 565, and maybe offer an idea to you, because I know you're struggling with the tax credit issue, and I totally understand that. Along with this issue, we've been in another committee hearing Senate Bill 85, which creates partnerships, public-private partnerships for seismically retrofitting buildings. And you might be able to somehow take a tip from that angle and utilize, if a historic building is going to be upgraded, somehow that they would be required to do a seismic upgrade at the same time, especially in areas along the coast where we're going to be having the Cascadia event anytime, any day now, any minute now. You never know. So, and I did see that Astoria was here. I won't double back on that. But there are a lot of buildings, as you've heard, throughout the state. Everybody gets a shot at these kinds of things. But if you consider that, and we're trying to get that across the board, when somebody does an energy upgrade, for example, we're asking that they do a seismic retrofit at the same time so that we can keep our buildings safe. So thank you for sticking me in the middle of this. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Rep. Boone. Any questions for Representative Boone? If not, we'll let her get back to work in the Ways and Means.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so we have a panel here on this bill. Keep your comments to 2 minutes if you can. Identify yourself at the beginning. And
don't
feel the need to read
Okay, I'm going to be brief. My name is, nice to be here, and thank you for hearing us. And my name is Pam Hayden, and I'm a board of director and speaking on behalf of the Bosco Mulligan Foundation and the Architectural Heritage Center in Portland. This organization would like to go on the record in support of this bill to provide financial incentives to property owners of commercial historic buildings who can use this money to renovate and revitalize our main streets and downtowns. Thank you. Oh, did you hear me?
Yeah, you
okay.
A little bit away.
Good morning, committee members. I'm
Mary Lou Culver. I'm president of the Lake Oswego Preservation Society. What I wanted to say is a Seattle wedding and a Philadelphia funeral, what do these ceremonies have in common? There's a woman who tried to save an abandoned Seattle warehouse by marrying it, and a funeral was held for a vernacular Philadelphia townhouse prior to demolition. Both of these ceremonies were intended to honor buildings that were an integral part of their communities. Why are people willing to invest time and effort and money in such an unorthodox and potentially useless act? The only answer is that buildings matter. Places matter. Humble, grand, and everything in between. Buildings house our personal and collective memories. Structures that shape these memories all too often meet an unfortunate end. Let's prevent these tragedies from being enacted on a statewide stage in conflict with Oregon's Planning Goal 5, as well as preservation efforts throughout our local communities. Every current and future Oregonian should have the opportunity to experience, enjoy, and be enriched by these buildings. Main Street buildings are an integral part of our unique heritage. As Richard Moe, the former president of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, put it, there may have been a time when preservation was about saving an old building here and there, but those days are gone. Preservation is in the business of saving communities and the values that they embody. Please join us in seeing a future in our past. Please support the Revitalize Main Street Act, SB 565. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Hi, I'm Walt McMonies, 601 Southwest 2nd Avenue, Portland. And I'm representing the Masonry Building Owners of Oregon. I've got a PowerPoint which I'll blow through, and obviously you're not going to be able to get completely through it. Here's support passage of SB 565. I've personally undertaken a seismic upgrading of a historic apartment building. There are about 3,000 URM apartment and commercial buildings in Oregon. Now, historic and URM aren't always the same. There are definitely lots of URMs that aren't historic, and there are lots of great historic buildings that aren't URMs, but there's a great overlap between the two. And of course, with the seismic issue, that's the thing that's really facing people with URMs, is getting the funds to be able to seismically upgrade these buildings. That's what you need.
Okay, I got it.
Okay. You've already heard testimony on how important these older buildings are, and the URMs are the older buildings. URMs were generally built from 1880 to 1930, and they constitute most of the old historic buildings that aren't wood frame residences and wood frame churches and that sort of thing. Let's see, the deficiencies of URM buildings, well, they don't do well in earthquakes. They do well on almost everything else. URM buildings are facing needs not just for seismic upgrades, but for fire code, ADA, energy conservation upgrades, et cetera. These mothball buildings with retail on the first floor and three stories of warehoused, completely mothballed space above are a fact of life on Main Street and in small towns all around Oregon. SB 565 is designed to spur renovation of historic buildings, and a lot of those are URMs again. Let's see, mandatory upgrading, hurdles to upgrading. There are significant hurdles to funding these upgrades, ranging from difficulty of obtaining subordinated construction loans, owners having insufficient liquidity or cash flow from their buildings to fund the project, limited return on seismic upgrade investment, current commercial lending and casualty insurance practices which penalize URM buildings. But if we don't do anything, these buildings are going to collapse, and particularly if and when the mega earthquake comes. This is the building I've seismically upgraded. It's called the Trinity Place Apartments in Portland. It's 46,000 square feet.
Wait a second. What do you mean you seismically upgraded?
Well, I wasn't personally handling the tools, but we retained a masonry contractor, and we are about 50-60% through seismically upgrading it. This is what's up there now is what we're doing. One of the issues that you have is floor. In the old buildings, they did not tie floor joists and roof joists to the walls. They just had little niches in the walls, and the joists would sit there.
Right, and I understand you did the legal work for this project.
I own the building.
You own the building, okay. but you're doing this.
Yes.
In absence of any financial incentive?
Only because this building has, there were financial incentives in place that allowed me to do it kind of uniquely. I had a very low tax basis, so that allowed me to use the federal 20% ITC. There's a historic, federal historic 20% credit. I got that. And then there used to be a very vital and vibrant special assessment program, which held your property taxes down while you were restoring a historic building. That's kind of gone by the wayside because now you've got 3% limitation anyway, so that doesn't help you. But those were the financial incentives that helped me do this, and I'm somewhat of a unique case.
Do you own other buildings?
Yes.
And you would like financial assistance to help?
You know, I'm really not looking for this for me because I think I've got the wherewithal to do it. It's the people who don't have the wherewithal to do it that are the issue. But for a bill like this and but for maybe SB 85, which is the funding idea for construction money coming from local governments, I think a lot of these buildings are going to go by the wayside. This is a somewhat unique building that actually did get the work done. Lots of, just in Portland alone, there's 1,765 URMs. Statewide, there's literally thousands of them, 3,000 to 5,000, depending on who's asking. Upgrading a URM is cost-effective. In San Simeon earthquake in 2003, there were 53 URMs in Paso Robles, California, near the epicenter. And of the nine that were seismically upgraded, none of them suffered major damage. The other 44 basically collapsed or were red tagged and had to be taken down. So you can do this. Lenders and insurers respond to risk. Well, one of the problems is that the lenders are running away from URMs. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that finance apartment buildings, they won't make loans unless you've seismically upgraded them. Insurance companies are charging much higher insurance rates now for earthquake insurance. It's gone up 235% in one situation. You know, it used to be $17,000 for all the insurance on a building like the Trinity Place. Now it's like $50,000, of which 17 or 18 is just the earthquake insurance. Hurdles to
removal. Sir, I'm going to have to cut you off. We've got a lot of people.
No problem.
And I appreciate your story, and I think we kind of see the seismic needs here. Any questions of this panel?
A question for staff.
Senator Bartsugger.
This proposed tax credit, would that be transferable?
As the bill is drafted right now, it's not transferable. The tax credits are sold at auction, so presumably only the people who could actually use them, because they're separated from the projects. Any taxpayer would come in and buy a tax credit. The money goes into the fund, and then the fund would go to the project owners.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. See, where are we here? John Goldenberger, Jonathan Stone, Barbara Kerr.
Excuse me, Senator Hass. I think you skipped Julie Garver. She was up at the front of the list there, and I didn't want her to be left out.
Julie Garver. I did.
She was in the first panel.
I thought I mentioned her in the first panel. Julie, why don't you come up here? Thank you for pointing out. Ms. Garver, thank you.
Thank you very much for hearing this issue today. My name is Julie Garver. I am with Innovative Housing. We are a nonprofit in Portland, and we develop affordable housing. And I wanted to tell you briefly about a couple of the projects we have been able to do, and then I want to tell you briefly about the ones that we haven't been able to do and why. We have about 1,000 units in the Portland and Willamette Valley area. We've done 8 construction projects in the last 7 years. Half of those have been historic buildings. We love the historic buildings because they create a real character and heart in the community and just add something that we aren't really able to provide with new construction, affordable housing. In the larger projects that we do, we have the benefit of being able to use low-income housing tax credits, which fills a gap that we might not normally be able to fill with historic buildings, and so we're privileged to be able to do that. The Erickson Fritz is under construction in Old Town right now. We're employing 50 people a month for a year on that project to do all those seismic upgrades that you just saw in the previous presentation. But I wanted to give you an idea. Out of $7.5 million of construction cost on this project, we're building 62 apartments in these buildings, $2 million of it is seismic. So it's substantial. You know, it's hard to make these projects pencil. We were able to do it here because we have $6 million from the city of Portland. And that is a privilege, but it doesn't happen very often. It doesn't come along very often. And so we're privileged to be able to do that project. We did one without any public subsidy. It was a small building, and we were able to do a robust partial seismic upgrade on that one. If I had to do a full seismic upgrade on this two-story, 16,000 square foot building, I wouldn't have been able to do the project because Wells Fargo would not have given me the loan. It wouldn't have appraised. So if I had done a $2 million seismic upgrade on a building that was only worth $2 million, you can see the economics of that wouldn't have worked. So, but again, that partial seismic upgrade, I was very lucky to be able to do that, because you can hear the testimony that says we want full seismic upgrades. And it's understandable, but it's really, really expensive. Now, a couple of the buildings and projects that I can't do right now. There was a great building that was owned by Chinese folks in downtown Portland called Sui Sing. I had a gap. The full seismic upgrade put it beyond my reach, even with the low-income housing tax credits. And so I still had this gap, even with the federal historic tax credits, the low-income housing tax credits, some money from the city of Portland, I still couldn't fill that gap for the seismic upgrade. Another building that I really want to do right now is the old fire station in Old Town. There was a picture of the before in the slideshow that Peggy presented. It's a clinker brick building, one of the few left in Portland, and it would be great to do this project. However, it has a canyon, a cliff, and 80 feet of unstabilized fill underneath it. You can imagine some of the things that are happening to this building. I have to put $2 million into the underneath side of the building, into the soils. And then I have another $1.5 million in stabilizing the building itself. It's small. It's 7,000 square feet. And the small ones are particularly hard because I can't do some of the other tools that I have in my toolbox to preserve those buildings. And so that's why this bill is really needed. And I'll leave you with three things on why might this not be done anyway. You know, that was one of your questions, is why can't this be done by the regular market? And there's three things that I want to leave you with. One is small rural projects. The Rich building that I told you about that I was able to do, it was only 16,000 square feet. I couldn't get federal historic tax credits on that because I can only generate about $600,000 worth of tax credits, and you can't find a buyer for those federally. And so the small rural projects, those are really tough nuts to crack because you don't have some of the other tools available. The second issue is seismic. You've heard a lot about that, so I'm not going to repeat, but it's a biggie. And the third issue is mixed income, mixed use. Affordable housing, people have mixed feelings about it, right? Because we've all seen them done that don't necessarily get done really well. We want to do them really well, that help communities and not just help the buildings. And what that requires is mixed income and mixed use. A lot of these downtowns, they want commercial and retail on that ground floor. They want market rate units in these and not just affordable units. And that's the way I think it should be. And we've developed projects like that. But the market rate units and the commercial retail, those are incredibly hard to finance. I can't finance those with low-income housing tax credits. And so I can maybe get 10 units. I got 10 units of market rate housing in the Erickson Fritz, but no commercial because I couldn't fund it. And so building healthy communities, making these projects really sing, really doing the best thing for the communities requires an extra tool that we don't have. And that's what we're asking for. So thank you very much.
I can add another building to your list on seismic upgrade needs, the Oregon State Capitol.
It's a beautiful building.
We're all very aware of the cost of seismic upgrades, but this building is in dire need, and we're really not sure what to do, but it's a 2 or 3 year project for tens of millions of dollars.
And well, there's a bill that might be able to help you with that.
We need more than $12 million.
Thank you.
Maybe if we got the McMinimum brothers to the panel that I just named before Julie.
Little theaters.
If you could come up, I think I have John Goodenberger, Jonathan Stone, Barbara Kerr. Thank you. Try to keep it 2 minutes. Identify yourself.
I'll start. My name is John Goodenberger, and I'm here representing Clatsop Community College and the Historic Preservation Program. I am really sympathetic and to the comment about the sweet spot about Astoria, because we have a Main Street program, we have two historic districts, we have tons of special assessment and federal tax credit buildings there, and we even have a facade improvement loan through one of our banks, and we're rebounding. But we've been doing this for 30 years, and we're still not done, and there is still the seismic issues. The fact that we are coming ahead, you know, you have this example of Fort George Brewery. That was a bombed out building not long ago, and now it has 80 jobs in it, in the community. We had a Fisher Poets gathering this weekend. Thousands of people came, in an old renovated bus station is one of the venues for that. So our old buildings are really helping us come again and come back out of a slump. But as an adjunct instructor in the Historic Preservation Department, I'm really aware of the direct impact that preservation has on jobs. Rehabilitation puts more money in the hands of skilled craftspeople than in materials. And in new construction, there's a 50-50 split between the materials and labor. And in rehabilitation, it's a 60-70% goes into the hands of craftsmen and the people who are shopping locally, hiring locally, and you know, paying all those taxes. And at Clatsop College, we are training a workforce to take its skills throughout Oregon. And we've been at it for 6 years, and we are continuing to grow. We now have 16 students in our program from all over the nation. And the Revitalization Act will increase the work opportunities for my students. So I'm, you know, looking out for them here. To be clear, this rebate is not a giveaway. It has to have qualifying standards, and you have to, in order to earn that rebate, you have to meet the Secretary of Interior's standards for rehabilitation. So not every project will qualify that applies for this. The money collected through the auction of tax credits will be well spent. It results in quality work provided by trained craftspeople. And as seen in Astoria, historic preservation results in tax-generating assets. So I really would encourage you to pass Senate Bill 565. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning, Senators. My name is Jonathan Stone, and I'm the Executive Director for the Downtown Oregon City Association. I also have a number of other roles related to heritage and a background in architecture. I don't want to repeat much of what was said, but it all applies to us. But more specifically, what when I look at our district and its needs, I'm faced with this question of how do we accelerate economic development, recruit professional, higher-paying jobs to our district. Well, they want those special places to go to. And so we're faced with, but maybe once those jobs get there and there's a larger tax and employment base in that district, some of these incentives are less necessary. But I see the tax credit as an economic development tool that we could use. And the other one is we're faced with the incredible opportunity at the Blue Heron mill site adjacent to Willamette Falls. And a number of those privately owned properties could take advantage of this program. And it will help, I think, us to implement a much richer place, which I know that the entire state of Oregon is looking forward to its redevelopment. At least I think they are. So that's my two points. We look at the district, and our property owners are faced with driving down vacancy, filling spaces, but in the charge to do so, they maybe miss opportunities to do it better, which in case they would even have to develop more jobs, higher paying jobs within the district. So thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Barbara Kerr, and in 1977, I started a business in a 1910 storefront building on North Albina Avenue in Portland that my partner, Jim Kelly, had purchased for $1,000. It was in the process of being condemned. The business we started on the 900 square foot ground floor was Rejuvenation House Parts Company, later changed to Rejuvenation Inc. We sold salvage parts for people repairing, restoring, or sensitively renovating their homes and buildings, mainly in the Portland metro area. As we began manufacturing period lighting to fill the need for light fixtures that had been removed over the years to modernize or scrapped in the war effort in the 40s, customers came down from Seattle and from all around Oregon to our store. After several years, we started selling mail order, and our catalogs were requested nationwide and beyond. We manufactured lighting for movie stars such as Harrison Ford and for Goldie Hawn's house in Aspen, as well as the Shiseido Cosmetics factory in Japan. When the White House electrician called with an order for 100 light fixtures for the library stacks in the old executive office building next door to the White House, our crew wrote their names in the canopies. That's the part that goes up against the ceiling. Our crew were hired locally, including new immigrants. Many had young families and just entry-level skills. It meant a lot to them to know that the light fixtures that they had built individually were installed in one of the most important buildings in our nation's capital. Of course, we had long outgrown our small storefront and its basement workshop, but we didn't add on or tear down to expand. We bought a much larger early 1900s commercial building up the street, and then another existing building across the street for our manufacturing plant. After 14 years, I sold my half of the business. My partner expanded the store again into yet another commercial building on Southeast Grand, and the manufacturing into a 1930s building on Northwest Nicolai. Since then, satellite stores have been established in Seattle, Berkeley, Palo Alto, and LA in old commercial buildings. From that small old storefront, saved from condemnation, a multi-million dollar business grew, always nurtured by the historic buildings it occupied. Until in 2011, the business was sold to Williams and Sonoma. But the influence of what that storefront had started continues on in the many architectural and old house parts supply businesses that were spawned from Rejuvenation. I have no idea how much economic development, jobs, and money that Rejuvenation and its follow-up businesses have brought to Portland and Oregon, but I do know that without old commercial buildings, we and they could not have grown as we did, or maybe not even started. Real estate prices have soared, and I cry to think of how many of our old storefronts we are losing in the epidemic of demolitions we are experiencing. We need the legislature to support saving our old commercial buildings, not just for their history, but for our economic development. Purchasing old buildings has enabled many Oregonians to grow companies and careers. Because we did not have the capital expenditure of building new, the only money we borrowed to start Rejuvenation was $2,500 from my mother's credit union. We could start small and grow by making better long-range decisions rather than having to do what it took to make the next month's loan payment or rent. Businesses investing in their own equity rather than paying the higher rents or mortgages of newly constructed buildings have more stability. From the taxpayer's point of view, the result of money spent on supporting bricks and mortar preservation is still there for the community, even if that business moves on. But investment in the preservation and reuse of our historic buildings goes beyond the brick and mortar walls, beyond spawning a small businesses that are the backbone of our economy. Buildings with history connect the companies that occupy them with the community. That's good for our neighborhoods, cities, and the state, and it's good for business. Preservation and reuse of our historically significant structures is even more than saving our history. They and even the buildings like the ones that Rejuvenation has grown from are daily proof of our city and state's longevity and are an irreplaceable necessity for small business. Supporting the preservation of old buildings provides stability for business owners, for our communities, and for our economy. What better return on investment can you ask for?
Rejuvenation is a long time Portland landmark and
yes.
A great institution, and we wish it was never sold. Any questions for our panel here? All right. Thank you very much. Kelly Havercade has left, I believe. So I'm going to call up Eve Silverman, Steve Von Eck, Richard DeWolf.
Good morning. Eve Silverman, Amity Downtown Improvement Group. Amity is a really small town, about 20 miles north of here, population about 1,600. Our downtown is old, and it consists of about two blocks. 3 years ago, the State Historic Preservation provided a survey of some of the historic buildings in our downtown area. And these two blocks are our commercial strip, and you can see they're mainly, the boxes are black, which means those are eligible contributing buildings to a potential historic district. Unlike the other speakers this morning, none of our buildings are listed on the National Historic Register. Possibly in some of these small towns, people are a little resistant to government programs and interactions. And fortunately, because it's an affordable area, a lot of people have purchased those buildings but have done nothing to them. Fortunately, it means that they haven't been altered in a way that would make them non-historic. One of the buildings was an old schoolhouse that was moved from the schoolhouse square, was built in the mid-1850s, and is now an antique store. We would want an economic development tool to be able to encourage building owners to do appropriate rehabilitation. And if that means adding this to a tool for them to use and encouraging them to list their properties, which would be eligible for a historic district, and then coupled with a state tax credit and a federal tax credit, may be something that will help us preserve our architectural heritage. It's very important. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. And to say Amity is resistant is kind of an understatement, but go ahead, sir.
I'm Steve Eneck. I'm with Yale Union. Yale Union is a nonprofit organization in Portland, Oregon. We're right on Belmont in the Central East Side. And there's a building there, the historic Yale Union Laundry Building, that our nonprofit is the occupant of. This building is nearly 40,000 square feet. It takes up half of a city block. It was built on top of a creek in 1908, which still runs through the building, and it has one of the most expansive, beautiful rooms in Portland. We've activated this building with our cultural programming. There's exhibitions, film screenings, performances, concerts, educational programs, a library, an arts library, and it's had a very active and large audience. Also, we've activated the space by kind of parsing out some of it to lease to small business startups. There's also been there's a whole publication program that goes on in the building. So it's a mix of charitable and startup business uses in the building. Now, the problem is that there's a seismic upgrade that's needed for us to continue our programming. And that is very expensive. We've worked with a whole team to help us figure out the financing. We've worked on getting the existing tax credits. And even the mayor's office invited us to submit a proposal to them wherein the city of Portland would consider funding part of it. But we've not been able to quite get there. There's still a gap. And I think that this particular bill could fill that gap, and it would mean the difference between this significant community asset kind of staying in a stale, kind of like a stalled position, and it being activated. Now, if we were able to do it, it would, of course, have this profound impact by supplying a great number of jobs in the construction, but also we'd be able to increase the programming that we'd be able to do by offering more and more of it when the seismic upgrade allows us to have a greater occupancy. And for those reasons, I encourage you to pass this bill.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for having me. My name is Richard DeWolf. I live in Multnomah County, and I own two companies. They're called Arkiform and Versatile Wood Products, and I wear a lot of different hats. My education is in architecture. My passion is in preservation. My career is preserving and restoring vintage and historic buildings, but my day-to-day job is making sure my 75 employees, men and women, that work around the state have a good job, and they're kept working on a day-to-day basis. All 75 people are
very educated in this profession, and they all have living wage jobs, and these are full-time employees with things like 100% health care paid for and wonderful benefits. So working throughout the state, from the coast to Redmond to Roseburg and, of course, throughout Portland, we see a lot of projects start up, get excited about, and then fail because of funding issues. You ask specific questions about which projects could or couldn't happen. Sometimes there's money coming in from outside sources. I'm an investor in a project in Redmond now. If the city hadn't come in with a $1.5 million contribution to that project, it'd still be sitting there empty. It's sitting there empty now because we're working on the last financial issues with this project. And, you know, we're hoping any day that we could get this to pass. If the state tax credit was there, we probably could have had more vitality in the town 4 or 5 years ago instead of all these hurdles that we're coming across now. You brought up the McMiniman brothers as an example. We work on pretty much every one of their projects. And those goes to my projects that I invest in. The dollars need to be invested to keep the economy moving, but the dollars aren't limited by the borders of the state of Oregon. So as an investor, some projects aren't working for me. I'm looking at one downtown Portland right now that I just can't get to work, but I have this money that I need to start moving, and the same with working with like the McMinimans. They're investing $25 million, but it's on the outside of Oregon. I'm looking at projects because I can't make them pencil out here in other states, Washington, Illinois, Ohio, because of different tax reasons. So when you ask about which ones don't happen, it's kind of hard to give great examples of which ones don't happen because they're not there. It's like trying to explain to people how things don't work is because they're not there. So those are specific examples. Again, as an investor in historic buildings and somebody who employs 75 people, we try to keep a lot of our work in Oregon, but I do have to go where the dollars make sense. And right now, the dollars don't always make sense in the state of Oregon. This is my home, and I love to invest in this state as much as I can, and I'll continue to do so. So a couple other points. They were talking about the 1,300 jobs per year would be created. We could certainly expand on that. We certainly have the basis with the 75 people right now. Our staff has over $4 million alone in salaries that we contribute to. And then, of course, Senate Bill 565 can help small towns throughout Oregon revitalize their historic cores into vibrant community centers and economic engines. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of this panel? Thank you. Peggy Sigler and Beth Wytoski.
Good afternoon. I'm Peggy Sigler. I am the Oregon Field Officer for the National Trust for Historic Preservation. On behalf of the thousands of Oregon members of the National Trust, I thank you for the opportunity to provide a national perspective on the proposed economic development for Oregon's historic buildings. Over the past 20 years, the National Trust has helped 35 states create tax incentives for historic rehab. These programs attract private investment to restore historic properties that would likely otherwise be demolished. Time and again, the now appealing properties revitalize main streets, downtowns, and older communities. Historic tax credits are public-private investment and job creation strategies with great potential for increased private investment in communities throughout Oregon. A study of Ohio's historic tax credit program found that every $1 million invested by the state resulted in $8 million in construction spending and $32 million in operating impact with a total of 381 jobs. That's for $1 million invested. State historic tax credits leverage federal investment, as was mentioned, spurring even more rehabilitation. States with high-performing tax credit programs bring $3 to $7 million in federal tax credits back into the states each year. An economic impact study of this bill estimates that redevelopment would double with a net increase of more than $13 million of federal investment coming back into the state. And historic rehab creates more jobs. According to researcher Donovan Ripkema, historic rehab creates 5.7 jobs more than manufacturing would, or two more jobs than new construction for every $1 million invested, because it is labor intensive. As was mentioned, costs of rehab are typically two-thirds labor, one-third materials, while new construction is half and half. Labor and materials, often locally harvested, grown, provided sustainable materials for historic rehabs, tend to be hired and purchased locally. Historic tax credits are a critical reinvestment tool that revitalizes local communities, putting vacant and underperforming buildings back on the tax rolls. In Wisconsin, 60% of the state's historic tax credit projects in 2014 were buildings that were vacant the year prior. Historic tax credit projects act as a catalyst for redevelopment. In rural Evansville, Wisconsin, the renovation of a 1907 commercial building spurred the rehab of an adjacent 1870 retail building, and that inspired three more historic improvement projects on the same block in Main Street. So I urge you today to support the Revitalize Main Street Act, which attracts private and federal investment dollars to abandon and underutilized buildings in Oregon's historic downtowns, commercial areas, creating thriving, vibrant communities throughout our state. Thank you very much for the opportunity to provide testimony.
Ma'am. My name is Beth White. Excuse me. My name is Beth Witowski. I'm the mayor of Dayton. We are about 20 miles northwest of here, population about 2550. We're a town small enough that we can still plan a community potluck and assign dishes by last name and have it work. If you haven't been to Dayton, I'll personally invite you to stop by any Friday night of the summer. We have a festival every single Friday night that features our Main Street and our downtown, where our restaurants cooperate in dinner specials. Our storefronts are open in their flexible hours, and we provide free entertainment for our community and any guests. I've been sitting on our city council. This is my seventh year, and during that time, we've seen the development of our DCDA, which has helped get Dayton to be an Oregon Main Street city. We have done as much investment as we can at a local level. We operate with only a $4 million budget, including capital improvements and infrastructure. That's all we have. And we've done what we can in terms of money for painting storefronts, helping facade improvements, assisting with sign purchases and everything that we can in that respect. Our only investors are investing because of an emotional incentive and not a financial. Our businesses that have been restored over the last few years as we've gone through a big revitalization effort have done so because they love Dayton and because they know what we can be. We've struggled economically for darn close to a century since we've stopped our use as a shipping port. We've been supported only with our agricultural businesses, but we don't have much for tourism going. That started to turn around for us, and there has been significant investment, but as I said, it's because of emotional incentive and not at all for financial. Because of that, of course, our investors are very limited. We have a couple of people who own nearly every single building in our downtown area that is developed, including open lots. We do still have some vacancies that we need to see something go into, and I feel like that can best be done by incentivizing this so the people outside of someone so emotionally invested could hope to see it again someday. I think there's been a recent movement that we've seen in small communities, certainly in mine, for people to try to spend locally and support local business. We have an incredible volunteer base. We have several groups that support our economic development and lots of our practices that the city and DCDA have developed. But what we don't see are people willing to invest the dollars. And interestingly, you know, the investment of time has seen huge gains for us, but we have what we call the Dayton Forward Plan, and it's our broader plan for economic and cultural development, and it mostly uses our historic resources, as that's been what our residents and visitors have complimented when our DCDA has done surveys. People like that we're authentic, that we're rooted. We're called charming. It's very nice. And in order to expand that, we have to diversify our investors, and I don't think that we can do that without financial incentive. The emotional incentive simply isn't enough. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. And for your next potluck, if you want to go ahead and put Chris Edwards down for a salad. Well, thanks to all of you who came forward today. This, you know, like I said earlier at the outset, this is not something that we don't support. Everybody loves those old buildings and the Astoria Hotel and those buildings and Sisters. So we'll keep working on it. So thank you. Committee, I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 565. We're going to take time out now for a very brief presentation on Senate Bill 200 before we recess at 10. Okay? So I'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 200. Christine is here to give us the rundown. This is on capital gains.
We're done with central assessment. They're all leaving.
I thought Mazin had this. It looks like,
yeah, I like the
everybody's leaving.
I own this giant building, and I'm doing it myself, but I just want to help others. And he made the case for not doing this. That's what he did.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 200 would create a subtraction from taxable income for capital gains up to...
Folks, we're trying to conduct a business on another bill here.
Up to $1 million on certain investments. It applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2015. And so the qualifying investments would be those that were made to Oregon businesses or to a fund designated by the Oregon Business Development Department. That would be for the primary purpose of investing in Oregon businesses. So this would be businesses that were legally organized under Oregon laws. And it defines the investment as an exchange of cash for equity, debt, convertible debt, or control of an interest of, in a business. It excludes simply making a loan to a business, but does require that interest control an interest in the business in order to qualify. It also requires the investment to continue for a period of at least 2 years in order to qualify. And the measure also requires the Oregon Business Development Department to consult with the Department of Revenue and establish criteria and policies for certifying any net capital gain as qualified.
Okay, so we're looking at how much of a break for capital gains.
Mr. Chair, it would be up to $1 million, so it's the difference between the value when you get the investment versus the value when you sell. And so, yeah, it could be up to $1 million in appreciation.
Do we have a revenue impact yet, or is it too early?
There is no revenue impact yet, but I'll develop that if the measure moves forward.
So, committee, really what we're looking at here is some ways to do something about capital gains and try to encourage investment of that tax break into Oregon businesses, which is a difficult prospect. This bill, this concept, this idea has been around for a while, and really what I wanted to do was get it sort of a seed planted in your brain. And did you want to testify in the governor's office? Vince Porter is here. Who's been looking at this issue for some time, too.
To clarification,
yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, when we're talking about $1 million subtraction, we're talking about a subtraction from taxable income on active and passive capital gains, and really the taxes would be maximum tax rates 9%, isn't that right, staff? So it'd be the loss or the revenue impact is a 9% of the $1 million. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Porter.
Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Vince Porter. I'm the policy advisor for the governor on jobs and economic development. I have to start with a few qualifiers on this bill in the sense of there's been quite a bit of changeover since we worked on this in the summer. This was a bill that was put at the request of Governor Kitzhaber. I have not had a chance to sit down with Governor Brown, and so I can't speak to her position on this bill, and I just wanted that to be on the record. I also wanted to also talk about that when we looked at this, it was in the context of a larger and broader approach, and probably something, Senator Hass, that you're looking at of a holistic look at not just this as a single issue, but a collection of issues that we would want to try and tackle. And so I think our intent was not to suggest that this would be a standalone bill that would be a loss of revenue, but in the context of a larger, broader fix that would counterbalance various measures. So with those qualifiers, I think one of the things that we were looking at was just the issue behind capital gains, and something that you've brought up several times. It's certainly one of our more volatile sources of revenue, and one that's a little harder to predict, but it's also one that directly ties to, in a lot of ways, investment and success here in the state of Oregon. And we've tracked, and there's even been reports over quite a bit of time, and the age-old debate of, are people leaving our state to get a capital gains benefit and then possibly coming back, essentially going across the river and doing that. So really what this was intended to be was to look at capital gains as an opportunity to maybe provide incentive to keep that money here in the state of Oregon, but only from a reward from the purpose of economic development. So reinvestment in businesses, which is, I think, something that's even been done in the past here in the state of Oregon. I think it expired in 2005, if I'm not mistaken. But also one of the new things about that we added into this bill was also the idea of that you could send that money not to necessarily just an Oregon business, but also a qualified Oregon fund, whether it was something as specific as, a modification of the Oregon Growth Fund, or there's we've heard from many different sectors like the bioscience community, who's very interested in having an Oregon-based bioscience fund. So having the flexibility where Business Oregon could certify those types of funds that are really designed for reinvesting money back in the state of Oregon with certain businesses. And this also was on the backs of the capital scam report that the University of Oregon's College of Business put in last summer, which I think was a very interesting report that both Business Oregon, Meyer Memorial Trust, and a few other foundations worked all together to really look at the state of our state in terms of access to capital. And some of the things that they identified, I think, were very interesting. One of the things that they have identified is we're doing a fairly good job at our seed and growth capital for, like, the bootstrap type of businesses. So our seed companies are accelerators, like funds like the Oregon, the Portland Seed Fund, and other things are really starting and, quite honestly, have done fairly well. What we're not seeing as much, and I don't know if they had a specific answer for this, but it's something that we were interested in looking at, which is we're not seeing as much in-state venture capital and private equity investment. And really, reintroducing this was an idea of an open discussion about, would this be an effective tool to really get that started once again? the other part of the reason why that part, which was interesting to ask, was that the report, the capital scam report, specifically noted that we are behind in those two areas, from California and Washington in particular, and as well as New York. Now, I'm sure that there are other factors beyond, our capital gains rates between us and Washington, but it did certainly call that out. So just in conclusion, really the focus on Senate Bill 2200 was to open the conversation about, should we have a reinvestment incentive and use the capital gains to revenue to create that incentive, and how do we keep it as prescriptive as possible? And I'm not sure we got to our final conclusion. I think in putting this forward, we were open to a discussion with all of you about the right number, what the revenue impact would be. So certainly open to more work to be done on this as we move forward and to start discussing about a broader revenue reform issues.
Thank you. Well, that makes a lot more sense in my mind anyway, to have these sort of prescribed funds, laid out by Business Oregon, or the Bioscience Fund, Venture Capital Fund, as opposed to trying to figure out, well, I'm going to buy a new dry cleaners and down the street. Any questions, Senator Bocas?
I just want to follow up with a couple of comments and a couple of questions, because we had pretty intense discussions of this under the last administration, and I'm just remind everybody we were trying to figure out exactly, as Mr. Porter said, how to incentivize that reinvestment at the bottom layer. And of course, we in the small business side, you know, we took a stab at that because we excluded the passive income out, trying to say, okay, that's the stock market stuff, because we didn't know how to address this issue here. And it appears what we're trying to do here is, and correct me if I'm wrong, and that's some of the questions here, we're trying to put both the passive and the active kind of back together and create another, for when we say small business, we're really this category of businesses maybe even smaller than 100 million, because we're always in the 250 million in Nike and everything else. But the goal here is to figure out, even if it's capped, of how to create that investment capital at the bottom end. And I applaud the now departed governor, because he committed to having this discussion, which is why we have some of these bills here. And I encourage the incoming governor to continue that discussion. I mean, I don't know if this is the right way to go, but it jumps out as, Mr. Cherry, when you say, well, $1 million, well, it's actually not $1 million in revenue impact. It's that 9% cap that they're at. And then the next thing is, as pointed out in the bill, is trying to go down the road in front of us, is this issue of, you know, what we're really doing is we're reinvesting it and deferring it. You know, we don't call it a deferment, but what we're doing is saying you put your money back into Oregon, and we're saying Oregon here, and even one of the common funds you're saying. Now we have this pooled money, which we're back to the whole issue of 2688, and this we have now enough money to invest and create jobs. And then at a future point, they're going to cash that back in, and we're going to get the tax money back. So it's sort of a deferment, pushing it down, and it again, trying to push that issue. The only thing I see in here is that the commonality, I think, for everybody that's in this discussion, we need to slightly expand upon in Business Oregon. Mr. Porter can kind of address that. Is it what we want to do is we want to encourage this type of development if we do it, not in, I won't say a company, not in minimum wage jobs. We want to try and get this into the development of sustainable wage jobs in that category. And I don't know if that there's another piece in the old administration coming to the new administration to kind of address that issue, or whether that's a Business Oregon issue. And I'd kind of like Mr. Porter to respond, because I think all of our goal here is we're not interested in federal or state minimum wage. We're trying to get sustainable jobs here out of this stuff.
Chair Haas, Senator Brookquist, I think that's true. In talking to many other people about this concept, I mean, that definitely seems where you get stuck in the mud quite a bit over the description of what businesses, what funds. But I think certainly the intent is that we have capital investing in scalable companies in the state of Oregon that are providing above state average wage jobs. I mean, that would be the goal and the intent. How you thread that without you know, I think it's still something that we have to think through and do. But that's certainly our intent. And I meant to put in also another, in no disrespect to those companies that are not looking to be scalable and having 5 to 10 employees. I think those are great companies. But what we're seeing is what this was really to look at is when you get we're growing our companies, our startups up to a certain point, and then they get stuck in terms of the access to capital in state. And then they're having to look outside of state. How do we create that bridge, or what is our role in creating that bridge to getting them to scale here in Oregon and using money that exists here in the state?
Just one follow-up here. Sir. I think as part of the this and the broader discussion, it's important to note that, you know, I mean, this is, I'm not going to say a blank check, but I mean, I think there's plenty of room in here to talk about what Mr. Porter said, you know, scalable wood of the bumper boards. And there's also plenty of room because, I mean, though we in theory, one side says this works, one side says maybe it works, is putting this into a context of sunsettable or cappable or something like that to say, okay, we think this is going to work. We generally all agree this is going to work, but I don't think one side or the other would not be opposed to saying, okay, if we're going to try this, let's try this on a set time schedule to prove it works.
Okay, we'll make that the final word. Thank you, Vince.
Thank you.
Thank you, committee. This is one of several bills we'll have on capital gains as we look at this. With no other business before us, we will adjourn. First, we will adjourn. With no other business before